it's the awareness that every time that someone calls us dad or dada, we have the opportunity to pass on that faith, whether it's a birthday party, a gardening opportunity, or playing Paw Patrol with our kids.
Welcome to Dangerous Dogma, the authority on questioning authority. I'm Brian Kaler, president of Word and Way. You can learn more about us at wordandway.org. In this episode, we're going to have a conversation with Jonathan Hall and Beau Underwood about their new book, Dear Son, Raising Faithful, Just, and Compassionate Men. Jonathan is the senior pastor at First Christian Church in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and Beau is vice president for external affairs with Word and Way, which sounds like a really great publication. You should check them out at wordandway.org. As dads in this book, they have written letters, Beau to his son, Jonathan to his sons, but they're also dealing with some critical and difficult topics about what does it mean to raise children, and particularly young boys, in today's world. So I was excited to have this conversation with them. Their book is coming out the end of March. You can go ahead and pre-order it wherever you get your books. So here's my conversation with Jonathan Hall and Beau Underwood on Dear Son. Well, Jonathan and Beau, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Brian. It's good to be here.
Thanks, Brian.
You all are the authors of the new book coming out end of March, Dear Son, Raising Faithful, Just, and Compassionate Men. And I should note that this book is structured in the format of each of you writing letters to your son, Beau, or your sons, Jonathan. And I think that is that where we should start is a really important question of why do we have to write letters? I mean, why isn't this like text or tweets to our son? I mean, this seems like a lot of work.
It is a lot of work, and maybe it helps to answer that by starting with how this book began. When I had found out that we were going to be having a son, my first thought was excitement, and my second thought was, oh my gosh, I have to raise this kid. There's a lot of things I need to teach him. There's a lot of things that I don't know that I'm going to have to figure out. And I started to reflect upon how I really was going to have to take responsibility for the man that he was going to become. And that as we looked 18 and 25 and 45 and 80 years down the road, I wanted his life to be one that added to the solutions in the world, not one that added to the problems of the world. So I needed to raise him in such a way that allowed him to be a problem solver as opposed to somebody who, again, was creating or adding to some of the issues we face. So I was talking with Jonathan on the phone about my idea of maybe writing some letters to him because he can't understand as he was a child all of the things that we were going to be doing, all the reasons we were doing this or doing that, trying to teach him certain things, some lessons the hard way maybe. So I was going to try to write these letters to explain to him so later on he would be able to understand, well, that's why Dad was doing that, or that's why he was telling me that, or that's why he was insisting on that thing. And Jonathan kind of caught the spirit, and he's like, that's a neat idea to be doing to my own sons. And from there, it went to, well, what if we wrote these letters together to what maybe a publisher would be interested in publishing them so other dads could see what we were doing. So letters allow us two things, right? They are lengthier than a tweet. They are lengthier than an email even. And so we can often write with more thoughtfulness and more clarity and more substance than other forms. But the other thing is that they're a form of passive communication. Like, I hope my son takes these letters that I wrote him and reads them and chews on them and thinks about them and puts them down for a bit and then picks them back up and thinks about them some more. So what they allow is they're not as confrontational, but they really allow for reflection. They allow for absorption. And I hope that when he reads them someday that he'll understand why I parented the way that I did, and hopefully they'll have the effect that I intended.
I do think that these communications with our boys, it takes more than 140 characters, right? I think it takes two characters, right? Like when I write my letters, I write them individually to each son. And so I actually do it once a year now, to where I kind of share, hey, this is what you did this year. This is how I felt. And I just sort of take note throughout the year to kind of call out things that are quite sacred moments that I hope both of us remember. And the joy of it is that it'll show a process for both of us, process where, you know, this is what I thought you need to know when you were 5. And then whenever you became 15, I totally rethought things. And so I think that'll show the beauty of the process of what it's like to grow up as a son and to be a father. So that's why I think it's exciting to have it as the form of a letter, because it is passive communication, yes, but I think it's a way to ensure that we can think critically and spend the time that it needs to share our hopes and our dreams. And if it was like a one-on-one conversation, those things can be forgotten, can be misunderstood and taken different ways. But this is simply just, these are my hopes and dreams. I'm probably messing it all up, but this is what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, you make this comment about, you know, I'm probably messing it all up. And that is something that you all both acknowledge in the introduction, that this is not a, you know, a guidebook for fathering. This isn't you all saying that you have cornered the market or got it all figured out. I mean, obviously your sons are too young for us to know whether or not you're any good at this. So, you know, isn't that hopeful advice of like, you know, we'll wait a couple more decades before you realize if you did anything right. But, you know, I wonder if you could talk about that idea of why you decided to publish this as a guide with that acknowledgement of like, hey, we are, you know, in the midst of this. We have no idea what we're doing well, what we're not doing well, but we want to encourage, like, again, a bit more about what the goal was of this book from the two of you.
Yeah, so when you Google parenting advice, things get really sketchy really quickly. There's a lot of pseudoscience out there. There's a lot of really bad ideas that are presented as authoritative. It doesn't take long for you to realize that one person says up and another person says down. I don't want to speak for Jonathan, but I am not an expert in being a dad. I like to tell people that I'm not even the best parent in my own house, which is true. So for me, this wasn't about telling other people how to be a dad or how to be a parent. It was just an authentic expression of what fatherhood was like for me, what I was hoping to accomplish in raising my son, and inviting other people to risk that vulnerability and share their own authenticity in writing their own letters. So we don't want to be the person everybody turns to for advice. We do hope we are models, not of how to be good dads, though we hope that too, but more models of how to really build a relationship with your son through this act of letter writing.
I would echo all that you said, Bo, about not being the best parent in my house. And I think that our wives probably laughed whenever we said, oh, we're going to write a book about this. Maybe they have a sideline conversation that we have no idea about. But I hope that if they are talking on the sideline, it's that they're at least trying to figure it out. I think that's the goal with the book, too, is that we are all just trying to figure this out. I mean, I remember leaving the hospital after a few days with our first son. I remember thinking, wow, you're going to let me take this baby and just leave? Like, seriously? Like, I have no idea what I was doing. Personally, I read probably like 6 or 7 books on fatherhood, just trying to like figure out what I was doing. And there are lots of bad things out there, a lot of toxic masculinity, a lot of, you know, this is what you do. You just need to bring home the bacon. And I heard, oh, well, fatherhood doesn't really start until they're like 2 or 3 when they can start playing and messing around. And like that didn't feel right. And I had models of parenting. I mean, obviously I came from really great parents, both my mom and my dad. But I remember when Annie and I, my wife, we started talking about having kids, I immediately started looking for role models. And I don't think that's the purpose of this book, that Bo and I are trying to be role models. It's more of, we're trying to figure this out and we invite you to help you. We invite you to try to figure it out with us. And so, you know, I have sent books to a handful of young dads. And I said, just so you know, I was watching you when I was thinking about being a dad. And you were a great model of that. And I have sent them books because they were incredibly formative to me. And so I think it's very hard, I think, for any parent to try to figure out who do I want to be instead of who do I not want to be, regardless of who our parents are. But yeah, just that image, like leaving the hospital, I felt totally unequipped to do what I was about to start doing. But I did know, and I mean, Bo and I are both ordained pastors. And, you know, I do remember that, you know, Billy Graham, like him or love him or hate him, however you feel about him, at the end of his life, he said his biggest regret was not spending enough time with his family. And I remember that often. I can put myself into my work, no matter what our work is. But for to have someone like that, who rose to that level to say not enough time with family, is a great reminder that we need to be aware of what we're doing when someone calls us dad.
Yeah, that trip home from the hospital, you're not hardly going any speed at all, and it's still like the scariest car ride you've ever you know driven in, and you know, and that sense of like, yeah, like I think I put this thing in this seat correctly, and no one's even checking. I'm just, you know, pulling out, and now I have to try to get across the town safely. And suddenly there's this sense of like alarm at every stoplight and stop sign that I hadn't felt before. So I want to talk about that a little bit. This, you all start the book, we're talking about the joy of fatherhood. And I think this is actually an important area to think about because, you know, in some ways it seems like we still live in a society that doesn't expect fathers to be engaged, to be, you know, excited or even joyful about being a father. You know, they'll go off to work and, you know, make the bacon and bring it home. I'm thinking about, you know, the Vatican recently tripled its paternity leave to 3 days.
Wow.
So instead of getting 1 day, when you have a child that's born, you now get 3 days. I mean, this is from, you know, the, you know, Pope Francis, who's supposed to be, you know, progressive on some of these, you know, issues of family and justice and so forth, right? You get 3 days. Or, you know, there was a lot of, you know, conservatives who like to talk about being pro-family that were making fun of Pete Buttigieg when he took some time off with their new child. And so, you know, it seems like we are in a society that doesn't often lift up the role of fathers being engaged in the lives of their children. And so I wonder if you can talk about that idea of the joy of fatherhood and why it's so important.
I think if we want to change the world, I think a lot of this goes on to how we raise boys and helping fathers be more than just sperm donors, right? I think it takes critical thinking and a lot of thought, because a lot of us just kind of go through the motions. And that was my biggest fear, because I can sometimes just go through the motions. And I desperately wanted to avoid any possibility where I would be going through the motions, because there are things that my kids are going to face that wasn't even on my radar as a straight white guy growing up in Alabama, right? I mean, I have kids that are biracial. Like, they're going to have questions that like I never had to face. So part of it is, yes, we live in a new time and all these things are changing, but there are also unique aspects that I think that are in my story, that are in Bo's story, that are in each one of our stories, of what are the things that I had to face and how did I face them? You know, we all face bullies, all that. They're mean, right? But where are the unique points that we need to face as we are trying to raise our boys? And so, you know, maybe we can spend some time talking about that, like some of the unique particularities that Bo faces, that I face, that I think each one of us faces. I think it takes a lot of forethought before those moments happen.
And I would just add to that I feel like we started the book with this idea of the joy of fatherhood because, you know, really that's the note where parenthood begins. One of the amazing things about being a dad that you really can't experience until you're there. You know, there's people I write about this in the book in one of my chapters. You know, when they find out you're expecting as a couple, people come and say, it's going to change your life. It's going to be great. It's going to be this most amazing thing ever. And you're like, yeah, okay. You know, part of it's your own anxiety, but they make such a to-do about it. You can't imagine as exciting as they say it's going to be. Nothing lives up to those expectations. And this is the one thing in my life that has. So one thing in my life that's been better than people promised it was going to be to me. You know, you can have a really stressed out day. Your mind's in a thousand places. You come home and all your kid wants to do is read a book with you. And you see how happy just sitting there and reading about the Bears, St. Bears for the 10th time that week makes them. And you realize what really matters in life. And there's this ecstasy that they find in just being with you and doing something that is not, doesn't look to the world as all that significant, but is profoundly significant, that really brings you joy. And we miss those moments in our lives, I think, as we get busier, as life gets more stressful, as we become sort of desensitized to some of those little small joys. And one of the beautiful things about having a young child is they bring all those things back and they allow you to experience that joy again that you really hadn't felt in some way since you were also a child. So I've loved that about fatherhood. I've loved having that joy. It's been an amazing experience in ways I didn't even fathom. But it's also something where I need him to be a reminder to me of to stop and sort of smell the proverbial roses.
And even just to piggyback on that, I mean, I had a friend whose wife just said, you know, I'm just kind of done being a parent. I just need to get out of here and be done. And that happens much more commonly, much more often with dads having that action, right? And it's been interesting among our friend group to go, oh man, it's gotta be so hard for him. You know, well, it's hard for any parent to have another parent just say, I'm done. But because he was the father in that situation, it seemed as if it's this really big outlier, but for any parent, that's a hard thing.
Yeah, and that's one of the issues that you all write about. And the subtitle should give people a little bit of a hint of this, the raising faithful, just, and compassionate men. You know, as we've noted, there are a lot of different fatherhood guides. There are a lot of different parenting guides. Many of them get into the realm of toxic masculinity. And you all are pushing a different perspective, recognizing that you are raising, you know, boys who will grow up to be men in an ever-changing world. And so you really lean into thinking about what does it mean, not just to raise a child today, but what does it mean to raise a son? And I want to talk about this on the couple of key issues that you talk about. Both, first of all, let's think about raising young boys to become men in a world where women are still often held back. And you were just kind of talking a little bit about this, Jonathan, right? That we have this double standard of this is, you know, the women's roles and this is a men role. And you have a chapter where you both write a letter on this topic. So why was this something that's important as you're thinking about raising your boys today?
Yeah, so starting where I said a little bit earlier is when you have the son or a son and you realize the world we live in with all these gender inequalities, the first thing you realize two things. First, your son's going to benefit from that. His life's going to be a little bit easier than if he was a daughter. And two, he's going to either make that worse or make that better. And so for me, it was about how to help him understand those dynamics so that he could make that world better. One of my favorite stories in the entire book is my son is very into Paw Patrol, and his favorite character in Paw Patrol is Skye, who is one of the few female pups because there's a gender inequality even in our cartoons. And he, I think, liked her initially because she was the one that flew versus driving vehicles. But now he, you know, wants Skye and everything that he has. And if he find something that has a Paw Patrol but doesn't have the female character in it, he won't want us to buy it. He doesn't want it. He only wants it if Skye's included. So he doesn't realize that he's arguing for gender equity. He doesn't realize that he's thinking about issues of inclusion. He just wants his favorite pup to be featured. But I really want to figure out how to nurture that attitude and keep it with him all the days of his life so that I can, you know, build upon him this sense of always looking around the room and seeing who's not there and who's being given an advantage and being one of those voices that says it needs to be a fair opportunity for everybody. I really want to nurture that within him literally from the day he was born. And we're off to a pretty good start, but we also know that the world's going to work against him. We know that these stained glass ceilings are real. We know that stained glass cliffs are real. And so helping him figure out how he can be an advocate for gender justice and not being part of the problem of gender injustice is really part of the mission with this book.
For us, we actually have a babysitting co-op that we've been trying to get off the ground to where we can, save some money and not have a babysitter all the time if we want to go on a date night. But we have families that we will have this babysitting co-op with to where, you know, some of them are like, there's a lesbian couple, right? There's African-American kids, there's Hispanic kids. I think it's very important that we try to normalize the things early in their lives for our sons. And so one way that we do that is through this babysitting co-op. And it's brought out some interesting questions about, well, why does this friend have two moms? And why don't I have two moms? You know, so we could talk about, well, some families have a mom and a dad, and, you know, it's all good and it's all beautiful, and letting them experience that when they're young, and, you know, having conversations around race. I mean, our oldest son right now wants to marry our youngest son, you know? And so we talk about how you can marry whoever you want to marry. And that really just means that you really love someone. He said, well, I want to be with him forever. Like, well, that's beautiful. You will find someone that you want to be with forever, instead of throwing those assumptions on him all the time, that one day you're going to be X, Y, and Z. And that really matters. And I mean, my sons are really big into monster trucks. Paw Patrol comes in a close second, but monster trucks. I mean, even monster, when we went to a monster truck show, we got pit passes and all that. And I cried everything. I mean, my 5-year-old was just ecstatic on the ground, just near the monster trucks. But even they were saying that monster trucks is the only venue where women and men can compete against each other in the same divisions. You know? So it's finding those things that even sound uber masculine, right? Lots of gas, loud noises, all that. You can make it, and you can be intentional. And I think that's the goal of the book, is helping dads be intentional about what they're doing, whether it's a babysitting co-op or whether it's going to a monster truck rally.
So y'all heard it here. A monster truck is the progressive sport.
It is.
But, you know, Brian, you do bring up something that I do think is important, because while we're not pretending to be experts, we do have a perspective from which we're speaking. And that perspective is in some ways defined against a lot of the other, especially Christian, quote-unquote Christian parenting materials that are out there. You know, Jonathan pastors in Colorado Springs, which is home to Focus on the Family. And even when I was in congregational ministry, you know, a lot of parents would come to me with these resources and these questions. And a lot of times that Focus on the Family was the first materials they had found. So they went and read Focus on the Family stuff, and they would have questions for me as a mainline progressive pastor about these ideas that were coming from a theology and a ministry that I disagreed with. And so we are not, this one book is not going to be the, you know, complete counterweight to Focus on the Family. But part of what motivated us in writing this is this understanding that there needed to be a different type of not just parenting perspective, but Christian parenting perspective offered on issues like gender, on issues like race, that would challenge some of those, unfortunately, dominant ideas that were out there that we think are pretty pernicious. I mean, the gender norms and the gender roles of an organization like Focus on the Family run, you know, not only in opposition to our values, but in opposition to our theology. But in a lot of even more progressive churches, there aren't resources there for parents to find. And so where do they go? They Google to Google. And what's the first thing that pops up is Focus on the Family. And there that theology seeps into our churches. So if we're going to parent as progressive Christians, we have to have resources for progressive Christians as well.
And so let's talk about the other issue that you also lean into in the book. In addition to thinking about gender inequality, you also write about racial inequality and discrimination in our society. And so what are your thoughts as you're thinking about raising your sons in, you know, addressing that as well? Basically, I know it's the same idea, right? They're going to either be part of the problem or part of the improvement in our society. But why was this also something really important that y'all wanted to write about?
For me, it's incredibly important, just because I'm going to ask, but my sons are going to face different questions than I did growing up. And one son probably more than another, if you just look on skin tone. But they know that if they come to my church office or if they see my office at home, I've got a picture of James Reeb walking across the bridge for the march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And James Reeb was murdered shortly after that. But I tell them, like, I look at myself and I look at that picture each day and I say, am I willing to be James Reeb? because I have benefited profoundly for my skin color. And they might have situations where that might come up. And I mean, even whenever we were leaving the hospital, my first son was so light skinned and had blue eyes, like many babies do, that my wife was deemed white as we were leaving. They just saw the baby and they deemed that she was white. So it's a huge issue for me and for us. I come from families where, I mean, there's a historical marker in my hometown about actions that my family was involved with in reverse integration in Alabama. And my grandmother being very involved with some cases that went before the Alabama Supreme Court. Yet I also have within my family tradition that we have a cake knife from the governor, because in the 60s and 70s, whenever you got married in Alabama, you would invite the governor to the wedding, and the governor wouldn't come. He would send a cake knife with his name inscribed on the side of it. And so I had to describe to my mom, like, this is why I can't use this cake knife, because it has George Wallace's name inscribed on the side of a cake knife. It didn't matter who I was marrying, but especially because who I was marrying, I can't do that. And so, I mean, race is, it's complex, and it's particularly complex within my own family. So this is something that I think about often.
Yeah, and we didn't set out to write a controversial book, but it feels like it's destined to become one, because it's going to end up on all the banned lists and all these school districts and places, because I dared to say something positive about critical race theory in the book. I wanted my son to understand that, you know, just as Christian theology talks about being born to original sin, that as a white man, he was born into America's original sin, which was the fact that, you know, white supremacy and white privilege have been the history of this country. And he was going to be the beneficiary again of those institutions. And he also had to work in his own life to counter those institutions. And I, you know, for me, understanding critical race theory is just about the way that that original sin pervades our societal institutions. And actually, there's a real Christian element to it in terms of the theology or the ideas that it teaches and the way that those align with Christian theology. And so really, for me, it was about helping my child understand the inheritance that white supremacy bequeaths to him, and him having to decide what he was going to accept and what he was going to reject when it comes to race, and really wanting him to think critically about what that all means in terms of when he, as he grows up. So we wrote this last summer, long before a lot of these critical race theory debates broke out, but now we're going to end up on all these banned book lists, which I'm assuming will drive up sales.
Here we go. So everybody ban this book. I mean, buy the book.
Ban it first and then buy it.
Well, you know, I'm sure being on this podcast will help, you know, win over your critics. So you also, in addition to dealing with some of these difficult cultural conversations that are important to lean into, I also want to highlight that you all also are very open about talking about passing on the faith and teaching your sons about following Jesus. And so I want to ask you about that aspect as well. Sometimes in our society, we almost, you know, have, well, we got the justice issues over here and we got evangelism over here. And I know that you all as pastors, as well as dads, don't see these as different areas of life, although they are different chapters. So I wonder if you can talk about what it is that you hope from a faith perspective as you're teaching your sons.
I think a lot about what I'm passing on to my sons, not just faith, but positive things and negative things. I am acutely aware of when one of my sons like will cry or hit himself. And I'm going, oh no, I passed on my struggle with low self-worth, low self-esteem, you know, all those things. So I think we have to be very aware of what we might be afraid of passing on. And so for me, I'm really trying to make sure in the positive sense that I'm passing on a faith that is based on openness, that's based on inclusivity, and letting him experience that through intentional practices of being around other kids and stuff like that. I mean, I was on Sunday nights, we do what we call special time. We have a little worship service as a family. So I've got my two boys in my arms, and we're reading scripture, this beautiful children's book that was, or children's Bible that was given to us. And I usually read ahead, you know, and I prep for it. And then we get out characters and we sort of do like this worship and wonder, like play, godly play type of a activity. And I turned the page because we usually do three stories, and we got to Abraham sacrificing Isaac.
My favorite.
Especially with two boys in your arms who really love, you know, we got the candle lit, all that's gone. And I'm going, oh, how do I teach this to my kids? And so I try to meet them where they're at. That, you know, Abraham was asked to do something really, 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 really hard. And he really, really wanted something, and he had to give up something, had to be willing to give up something. And so trying to make faith be something that's alive for a five-year-old and a three-year-old, I think is a monumental task. And so I asked them to give up their favorite monster truck. You know, what would that be like? And I showed them, if you look at my cell phone, the image that I have when you go to turn it on, it's a picture of my older son sharing his favorite monster truck with his younger brother and giving him a kiss. So feeling willing to give up something. And so obviously as they get older, the story's going to change a bit for them, and it's going to take on new meaning. So I want them to not just recite stuff, but to be willing to think critically and how their faith shapes them, and how, yes, we are made in God's image, but we also make God in our own image, and that often shapes us. And so I hope that as they are growing older, they're very mindful of how they are shaping the world and how their faith is shaping them.
And for me, one of the convictions I had long before I became a parent myself was that we really are increasing the expectations we place on kids in our society. So it seems like at a much earlier age, we're asking them what they want to be when they grow up. We're you know, scheduling them to the hilt in terms of all these different activities, whether it's athletics or theater or whatever. And we're trying to, you know, we're worried that if they aren't playing on the traveling baseball team by the time they're eight, that they're never going to make it to the major leagues, right? And it's like, we just load them with these, and it's a lot of it's parents living vicariously. We load them with these expectations, and we put them on their shoulders, and we weigh them down. And so I've tried, my wife and I have tried really hard to not have too many expectations for our son. You know, she says she just wants him to be kind. And that is, you know, really just a great goal for us, because there's a lot of ways you can be kind in the world. But for me, the other expectation I think we have is we want him to follow Jesus. And it sounds a little, not that we're making that decision for him, because in our tradition, faith is something that each person has to profess for themselves. But we think this is the most rewarding way of life that we know. We think it's a costly life, a life that will require him to make some different choices than maybe others in this world. And in our increasingly secular society, it's becoming a way of life that's harder and harder to live authentically. And so part of what I want to do as he grows up is to show him how following Jesus has made a difference in my life, not just in my professional ministry, but in who I am as a person and the values we hold in the world, the things that we do, and help him understand that we aren't doing this as punishment to ourselves. We aren't doing this, you know, as an exercise in sacrifice, or their sacrifice to it. We're doing it because this is the abundant life we think God offers to us. And I want to show him that so he knows that, right? So he doesn't just intellectually understand it, but he literally has experienced it and knows it, and hopefully wants to live that way for the rest of his life as well. I guess you might say that for as much as I just ragged on focus on the family, I'm really committed to evangelism when it comes to my son and wanting him to grow up and follow Jesus. So that is the expectation I bring. And I'm not going to be disappointed in him if he, you know, for some reason rejects the faith as he gets older. I'll probably be a little bit disappointed in myself, because it means I haven't shown him really who Jesus was.
And I think each milestone, each thing that we do gives us that opportunity to pass on that faith. So, for example, like for our oldest five-year-old birthday party, you know, we invited people to give to this particular website. And that website then kept 10%, he got 40%, and then 50% and 50% he got to choose which charities to give that money away to. And so we narrowed it down to six. There was one about caring for creation, one about helping young women, one about playgrounds, and so on and so forth. And we let him think about it for a long time. So this is totally up to you. You know, like as we think about what God might want us to do, God wants us to do all these things. But he said, for this year, I want to give to these organizations that help build playgrounds for kids that need it to be ADA accessible, because that was very important, because he loves playground, you know, and that's what really matters to God. And the other one was a nonprofit that helped young women learn their self-worth. And of course, I cried at that, but I believe that came out of his faith formation, and it gave him an opportunity to act out that faith. Same thing with gardening. You know, I love to garden. I get my boys involved in every step of the process, even the mixing of the steer manure. You know, they're involved in everything. And we talk about planting seeds, and we talk about, this is a lot like faith. You know, we put stuff out there and we just can bury it and see how it grows. And sometimes you do everything right and it still doesn't work out, and that's okay. So it's the awareness that every time that someone calls us dad or dada, we have the opportunity to pass on that faith, whether it's a birthday party, a gardening opportunity, or playing Paw Patrol with our kids.
Jonathan, you mentioned dealing with the stories and some of the difficult stories of the Bible, like Abraham and Isaac. And I mean, I'll confess that when my son was younger, one of his two children's Bibles that we would rotate and read through had that story, but I knew where it was, so I could just turn two pages at one time. And just, you know, skip over it, if you will, for at least when he was younger. We have since read it to him and talked through that story. But I wonder if I could ask both of you about this, because, you know, as dads, you both have been pastors, and this, it does seem like this is something that we struggle with in our churches, is how do we tell some of these stories to kids? And it seems we often even pick like odd ones to highlight. You know, we draw all of the Noah's Ark on the child nursery, but we at church, but we don't have all the drowning people off to the side. And so, like, what can we do better in thinking about telling, passing on the stories of the scriptures to young children?
I think progressive Christians can't skip over those stories, because Focus on the Family is out there sharing what they think it means. Our church members are already hearing what it means from people who will show up higher on Google than we ever will. So I think we're giving up a whole lot if we skip over it. And so I would implore dads who are trying to figure out life to not skip over that. I think you got to kind of figure out, how do I tell this to my kids? So I'm sure I'm going to turn a page in my children's Bible and go, ooh, not right now. But the thing is that our boys are going to hear words of formation regardless of whether we want it or not. And we have to make sure that our voices as fathers is one of those voices, if not the predominant voice. And we have an opportunity to do that with our boys. So I would implore you, don't skip over Revelation. Don't skip over Abraham's stories. Don't skip over the parts of scripture where it's, wow, you know, Israel is compared to being a prostitute or something like that. Like, I think we need to lean into those stories and find our voices in that. Because if not, we've given up the microphone to much more powerful voices.
When my son asks, what's a prostitute? I'm calling you, Jonathan, for a little help on the answer. So
I don't know where to go with that. I'm not going to touch that.
I would just echo a lot of what Jonathan said. You know, we have some patterns in our communal life, in our household, and one of those is my wife tends to do the morning routines with my son, and I tend to do the evening routines. And so she, lately, our child has been asking a lot of these questions about God. Why did God make, what's really funny is, why did God make me like this? Meaning, like, why did God make me like the color purple? Or why did God make me like Cheetos? And it's wanting to understand that, you know, role that God played in forming us in a way that only a 3-year-old can truly understand. And so, of course, being the ordained pastor, my wife comes to me and says, what do I say to these things? And she told me, you know, well, I told them the story about Adam and Eve. And I mean, I said, oh, no, don't do that. And I you know, got real like, please don't. And it wasn't about, you know, that Adam and Eve is wrong. It was more about like, you know, well, the reason God made you like this is because God desired relationship with you. And God acted out of love in order to create that relationship with you. And that's really what's underneath that Adam and Eve story. And so don't tell them just the literal biblical story. Tell them the sort of meaning behind the story. And she kind of looked at me and said, you tell them. Right. So she kind of was like, if you're going to critique how I'm conveying this, these stories to him, you're going to have to show up and do it yourself in the mornings. And so, but I do think what Jonathan said is we can't ignore these stories. There's a different way to tell. There's a different way to tell the Adam and Eve story than Adam was, you know, over Eve, and Eve was the one who committed the sin and messed up humanity, and it's the woman's fault. Right. There's a much different way to tell that story that is, I think, authentic to the Bible, and also teaches the right lessons we want to teach to our kids about what it means to be a Christian today. Just as I think there's a different way to talk about Noah's Ark that doesn't just make it the sort of story that's too often told in Sunday schools that leaves out all the drowning people, but also, you know, again, tells a story about God reforming the world in the way that God intends. That's actually quite beautiful, even if some of the imagery is hard for us to fathom.
And I think that's a good point, but I think our spouses both probably look to us to figure out the spirituality stuff. But I think we need to be aware of the times when we say, oh, well, that's mom's role or that's dad's role because of whatever. I think we need to make sure we include our spouses in on that. Because I know when we were looking at curriculum for our kids, Annie just said to me, well, this is your wheelhouse. Like, you got to figure it out to find a good one. But I think it's important to like bring her into the process. And so anytime that we sit there and say, well, Annie, my wife is trained in the dental field, you know, and like, so she knows a whole lot about teeth. She knows what's in people's mouth. I deal with what comes out of people's mouth as a pastor. And so, you know, I could totally outsource that. But I think one of the worst things we can do as a parent is to outsource any part of parenting. And so I think it's always a part of it. It's always an invitation to do that with another person. And if our spouse is reading the Bible to them and they come to the, you know, story of Noah's flood and all that, our spouses might take a different way. But like, what if we modeled it and said, well, what about the Babylonian creation myth that this is sort of built on, and how that's a counter narrative story? And like, we can nerd out over here and say, you know, there are stories, but then there are better stories, and invite our kids to think about that. And that our spouses won't do. And so I think it's inviting that mutual conversation and an opportunity to mutually form our kids, whether it's talking about the Bible, whether it's brushing our teeth, morning routines, nighttime routines. I think our kids notice that, because I tend to brush our kids' teeth at night too, right? And then whenever I'm not there, it's, well, Dada always brushes our teeth. So I think our kids realize who normally does things, and that is shaping them whether we want to realize it or not. And if we outsource a part of parenting, I'm afraid I'm passing on that to my kids, that, okay, only women deal with people's teeth. Or, you know, I think we just have to be very aware of that. And that's part of my weight that I carry as a father. I remember telling a friend of mine who I just sent a book for free, because I said, I remember talking to you about being a dad, and I was deathly afraid about being a bad dad. You said, well, if you're so afraid of being a bad dad, you're going to be a good dad. I mean, it's such a simple statement, but just a beautiful reality that if we're aware of what we're doing, we've got a better chance at this. And that's the aim of the book, is not to say that we're experts, is to say, hey, be aware, pull your awareness up. Bo and I, we're working on this book a little bit before a retreat that we planned, but we ended up going to the metropolis of Victoria, Kansas last year to work on this book together. And we went to this place and stayed at an Airbnb, I think it was, and there's a Cathedral of the Plains that's nearby. But it worked for us because it was halfway in between where both of us lived. And so what we're hoping with this book is that it serves as a devotional, that it serves as a way of sort of going away. You don't have to go to Victoria, Kansas to do this, but just to go away and to be intentional. So at the end of each chapter, there's room for you to write your story, to write your reflections, so that whenever you're writing your letter to your son, you can start with a little bit more awareness and grounding. So we hope that this will cause fathers to write letters to their sons as well.
We'll be right back with the rest of this conversation, but first, a quick word from a friend.
Hi, I'm Corey Nathan, and I host the Talking Politics and Religion Without Killing Each Other podcast. You can find us at politicsandreligion.us. That's politicsandreligion.us. We are your home for edifying, provocative, and fun discussions among high-profile public figures and regular folks like me. We talk about faith and politics and all kinds of topics that really matter in our culture. So if you're tired of screamers and extremists dominating the conversation and you want to join us in taking some of that space back, if you want to better understand different points of view, if you appreciate some nuance and just having a little fun, you'll love Talking Politics and Religion Without Killing Each Other. And remember, we're real easy to find. It's politicsandreligion.us. Hope to see you soon. We'd love to have you join the conversation on Talking Politics and Religion Without Killing Each Other.
So obviously, as you all were working on this book, and it doesn't come up as a key theme, but you were writing this book in the midst of a pandemic. We're still in some of that form, although, you know, in some ways things are looking better. And I wonder if we could talk about what this has also been like as parents, because, you know, on the news, we sometimes see the, you know, the parents who have been on, you know, the political side of, you know, whether it's, you know, showing up at school board meetings, denouncing critical race theory or mask mandates and so on and so on. But I mean, this has been a really significant period for our children, not just for our society, but this has been a significant moment that I think it'll be years before we really realize the full impact that it has had on children. And so I wonder what you all have thought about that experience of, I mean, talk about parenting in a time period where there's not an owner's guide or not a manual that you can find easily on Google. Other generations of parents that are alive haven't dealt with this type of, you know, plague, pandemic, upheaval in our society.
My kids wear masks everywhere they go. And one of my boys gets really upset when other people aren't wearing masks because he knows that we're doing it to protect other people. When he got his first vaccine, it hurt a lot, but we talked about how it hurts sometimes when you try to care about other people to protect other people, his younger brother who can't get a vaccine yet, or other people. And so I think for us, we made wearing masks, getting a vaccine, stuff like that, a part of your faith, a part of loving your neighbor. And, he hasn't deconstructed his anger at other people whenever they don't also care about their neighbors by wearing a mask and stuff like that. I mean, this is my son who would chase people on the playground. This happened multiple times last month or last year when they left trash on the playground. First time it happened, he ran to us and said, "Why did they do that? Why did they do that? It's making it dirty in here, and that's not nice." I said, "Well, maybe you can say something to them next time." Lo and behold, the next day at this campground, they left it again. And he walked after them, these young girls who were, I think, 8 or 9 years old. He said, "Hey, you forgot your trash. Come back." They ignored him. When it happened the third time, he literally ran after them to say, "You need to pick this up because this is making it not pretty over here." But it's a great opportunity to talk with your sons about how people are going to not follow the rules. And that's okay. But it matters who you are. And so each time he would come back in and talk to me. And I think that opportunity to dissect a situation is such a huge opportunity that we have as dads, that when things happen, my boys know that it generally ends with one of them sitting on a stair and me a couple stairs down, looking right in their eyes and talking about what happened. And how even if someone else didn't follow the rules, we know who we are and this is what we do. So it's hard to parent during a pandemic. It's hard to say, well, we can't see these people, you know, or we can't see those people, or we can't go visit Nana and Papa. But it's another way of showing love. And that is a way of acting out your faith.
Yeah, and as a pastor, one of the metaphors that always stuck with me from divinity school was the idea that the pastor is the moral guide. It is my job to, for those who are in my charge, to walk with them and be their moral, help them figure out the sort of moral requirements of living in the world as a Christian. And I think that I take that same approach with my child, right? It's my job to teach him how to live wisely in this world, how to make sense of the world, how to understand it, but then also know how to respond to it, how to act in accord with our values, his values, in a way that is faithful and in a way that is sort of with his, you know, in line with his character. And I've thought a lot about how he's not old enough, like Jonathan's oldest child, to understand a lot of what's going on right now. So hopefully this will all be over with soon enough that he won't have a lot of memories from it, but he'll read about this time in the history books. And he'll be like, what was that like, Dad? What was that like that we were, you know, what did you do? And I'll have to tell him about all the things we didn't get to go do and all the worries we had about when he was unvaccinated and not being able to, you know, protect him and how that made us fearful. But I'll also get to tell him about why we made the decisions we did. What were the values that underlined it? What guided it? And I hope that that kind of abstract reasoning sticks with him going through it all, because I really think that that's what we want him to learn. We want him to learn those values.
And I mean, my sons know, like, I stayed in our basement for over 2 weeks when I had COVID. And they were very upset at first, but then they said, yeah, but you love us. And that's why you're doing this. Like, they can understand the reasoning behind it. And I think that's one thing I really want my kids to know, is like the reason why I'm doing things. And I try to communicate that in my letters. That it might not feel right, it might have felt bad, but you have to know where I'm coming from and what I'm trying to do. So yes, it meant not playing, you know, playing with monster trucks, but also allowed us to learn a lot of cool features on video chatting, you know, where we could like make ourselves into elephants and stuff like that. And I think our kids are very aware of how we deal with difficult situations and making the best out of them. And if that isn't a part of the Christian narrative, I don't know what is. That's the story of the resurrection for me. That's what Paul talked about. Anakaphala oisistai, my favorite Greek word. You know, 22 yummy letters about how do we put a new head on it. And that's what I hope my kids learn from me. If I could choose one thing, it's being able to anakaphala oisistai, to put a new head on it. When people don't clean up on the playground, how do I put a new head on it? I can clean up after them. When people don't wear masks and I will, how do I make the best out of that? And so that's my hope and goal with being a parent, is giving them that tool set to be able to make the best out of the worst situations.
And you can learn how to spell Jonathan's favorite Greek word and much more in their new book, Dear Son, Raising Faithful, Just, and Compassionate Men. Thanks, Jonathan and Bo, for joining us on the program and for writing your letters publicly for us to peek in on.
Thanks for having us, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Dangerous Dogma. You can find more information and links in the show notes at dogma.wordandway.org. And don't forget to check out our website, wordandway.org, to learn more about our other offerings, including A Public Witness, a subscriber e-newsletter to help you make sense of faith, culture, and politics. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope that you will share it with your friends on Facebook and head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast platform and write a positive review. It really will help more people to find the show. If you'd like to give to support this program, we greatly appreciate it. And all you have to do at wordandway.org is hit the donate button. And whatever you give there will help support the production of this podcast, as well as our website, monthly magazine, and other offerings. If you have any comments or feedback about this program, you can send those to me at bkaylor@wordandway.org. Thanks for listening.